From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. Today, Hurricane Edward landed in Texas and was reduced to Tropical Depression Edward. As hurricane season picks up, there's a lot of debate along the Gulf Coast over how best to protect against a big storm. One approach is restoring wetlands. Experts say they act as natural speed bumps. NPR's Andrea Hsu explored one of those wetlands right in the city of New Orleans.
The Bayou Bienvenue is separated from the city's Lower Ninth Ward by a levee. The Lower Ninth had some of the worst flooding after Hurricane Katrina. On the land side of the levee, there are a few restored homes, but many more in various states of disrepair. Mostly there are empty, overgrown lots. Cross over to the other side of the levee, and you'll find a landscape that's almost as stark. A stretch of open water dotted with dead trees.
That's one of those cypress stumps. They're kind of hard to see because the water is so turbid.
Andrew Leaf and Amanda Perdzak are out in a canoe. They're students from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and they're part of a group that's been studying a 430-acre triangle within the bayou. Their work is part of a proposal aimed at restoring what used to be here, a cypress swamp.
50 years ago, this would have been cypress trees, and the water would have been a lot more shallow. We might not be able to get around in a canoe.
The students use the canoe to get to their test sites. They're looking at water samples and vegetation, and they're figuring out ways to bring sediment and fresh water back to the swamp. After all, Andrew Leaf says, it's saltwater that killed the trees. Here's what happened. In 1965, the Army Corps of Engineers opened a channel called the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, Mr. Go for short. It was built to provide a direct route from the Gulf of Mexico into New Orleans. Over the years, saltwater seeped from the channel into the bayou. Leaf has seen pictures before and after.
You can really see in the air photos. In the late 50s, this triangle was full of trees. It was almost fully vegetated. And then by the mid-70s, it was open water.
Now the Army Corps says it's going to close Mr. Go as early as this fall. And the proposal to turn that triangle back into swamp is in the running for federal funding. Andrew Leaf says their project represents only a tiny part of restoring a system of wetlands needed to protect the region. But it would be a good start. Out in the open water, it's hard to imagine what a healthy swamp would look like. Fortunately, you can visit one not too far away.
We're in Lafitte, Louisiana, about 15 miles south of New Orleans.
Bob Thomas chairs the Environmental Communications Department at Loyola University.
You're looking at a truly beautiful swamp.
We're walking on a boardwalk through 41 acres of thick vegetation, including cypress trees old and young.
It's really rare to go out and see cypress trees germinating everywhere like we're seeing today. And see, these are just germinating. See the little bitty ones right there?
And here's another sign of a healthy swamp. Frogs. That's the commotion in the background.
Okay, this one is going rank, 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 rank. It's a squirrel tree frog, and it's the mating call. Hear that little tick, click, 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 click? It's a cricket frog.
And then there's my favorite.
The narrow-mouthed toad. And right now they're calling in the water with just the tip of the snout sticking out of the water. To get out there and find one would be impossible.
Turns out, the same vegetation that provides cover for those frogs provides protection from storms.
See, if you had a big surge that came through this, imagine this. An 8-foot surge of water hit the edge of this. As it progressed through the forest, it would be diminished because it would be absorbed and slowed down and broken down so that at the other end of the forest, you'd have much less of a surge.
Just 100 years ago, much of the Louisiana coast would have had this kind of natural protection. Then over time came development. Man-made levees that prevented floods, but changed the way sediment naturally replenished the wetlands. Also channels for shipping and for oil and gas pipelines. Now the wetlands are disappearing alarmingly fast, and Bob Thomas wonders how long this swamp will be here.
We feel like we're standing in a pristine area, but we could drive 1 mile in several different directions and find devastation from saltwater intrusion. Makes you worry.
There's another one of those stumps.
Back in the city, Andrew Leaf and Amanda Perdzak have brought me to the edge of the Bayou Bienvenue to see the star attraction of this wetland.
The cypress tree is right there. It's next to those two dead ones. That's the lone cypress tree in our swamp.
In 430 acres of water once covered with trees, one living cypress bravely hanging on. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, New Orleans.
China is shooting a chemical agent into threatening clouds. It's doing that to bring on rain before the opening ceremonies to clear the air a bit.
So here in the U.S., Los Angeles County is also seeding clouds to help shore up record low rainfall. California has been in a drought officially since June.
Though the hope is to get more rain, scientists say it's not a sure thing. Celeste Headley reports.
Officials with Los Angeles County are very confident. Confident that cloud seeding works and that it can increase rainfall by 15% in the area along the base of the San Gabriel Mountains.
15% in those watersheds represents 4,500 acre feet. That's 1.5 billion gallons.
William Saunders is with the Water Resources Division for LA County. Los Angeles actually started seeding its clouds in 1957, but the program was halted in 2002 when fires burnt away a lot of the brush and ground cover, and there was danger of mudslides. Now, the clouds above L.A. County will again be filled with silver iodide in hopes it will create ice crystals that will fall to the ground as rain.
So the intent is to really reinitiate the program because we have the ability and to then carry on with it if we can.
Under natural conditions, sometimes only 20% of the water in a cloud will turn into rain or snow. Rolf Brunches of the National Center for Atmospheric Research says cloud seeding is designed to up that percentage, but it's not guaranteed.
Depending on the type of clouds you have in your region, depending on the type of pollution levels you have, cloud seeding may work better or may not work at all.
Gabor Valley is professor emeritus at the University of Wyoming. He studied cloud seeding for years. Valley says seeding is a bit like a brand new prescription medication. There are positive indications and promising evidence, but no real clinical trial to prove it's effective. When you're testing clouds, which are by their nature unpredictable, you don't have a control group to compare results.
And ideal situations, we know it can work. And there are some bits of evidence that such situations may sort of exist. But life is always more complicated than that, and clouds are extremely so.
Cloud seeding is used all over the world. In fact, right now in Beijing, they're seeding clouds, hoping to clear out air pollution ahead of opening ceremonies. Some places report thundering successes. This spring, newspapers in Saudi Arabia reported that an unexpected thunderstorm there was caused by cloud seeding tests. Brunches says such claims are ridiculous.
Those are all no scientific basis to them, and actually they go against the laws of physics.
Basically, Brunches says, you can't create clouds. You can only seed those that already exist.
You cannot make a big thunderstorm out of nothing. Neither can you make a big rainfall event out of nothing.
That's why cloud seeding is not a drought-busting tool, because in a drought, you have fewer clouds. But William Saunders says L.A. County's program isn't just meant to combat drought. He says it's a long-term strategy to increase water supply in the thirsty region. And he says they keep careful records to make sure cloud seeding is working.
We can determine what would be normal within a region, and then using the amount of rainfall afterward, after we've cloud seeded, we can determine whether or not we've actually achieved our 15% objective.
Over a four-year period, the cloud seeding program will cost about $800,000, and it will only be renewed if rainfall actually increases. Saunders says the county has more than a century of rainfall records to establish normal rainfall amounts.
No good. They won't tell you anything.
Gabor Valley says those records are mostly unreliable, and because weather systems vary widely from year to year, historical records aren't a conclusive measuring tool for rainfall. Even that 15% benchmark that Saunders is talking about is based on a rainfall study from the early 70s.
In principle, it looks like a promising and possibly rewarding thing to do, but they're taking a chance. So it's certainly much less certain than other things they could do with that money.
If the program does, in fact, increase rainfall by 15% in L.A. County, that works out to $2 million they don't have to spend bringing water from the Colorado River. Valley says it's a good thing to increase water supply, but the surest and most economical solution, he says, is to simply conserve. For NPR News, I'm Celeste Headley.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. If you go to Fort Worth, Texas, you'll probably notice a certain movie star on billboards, buses, in the newspaper, and you may see him talking on TV about natural gas.
The Barnett Shale is one of the largest natural gas fields in the United States, with nearly 40 trillion cubic feet of reserves right here in North Texas.
Yep, that's Texas-born actor Tommy Lee Jones. He's become a spokesman for Chesapeake Energy, the nation's largest independent producer of natural gas. And Chesapeake is the biggest player in the Barnett Shale. This formation lies under 21 North Texas counties, including Fort Worth. After 3 years of a natural gas boom there, some residents are losing their enthusiasm. NPR's John Burnett picks up our story.
So for the good of your family, for the good of the people, let's get behind the Barnett Shale.
The Barnett Shale is a wildcatter's dream. Wherever they poke a hole, they find gas. Energy companies are scrambling to drill anywhere there's vacant land, in country clubs, parking lots, city parks, school grounds, and airports. But a vocal and growing minority is not getting behind the Barnett Shale, as Tommy Lee urges, especially now that the pipeline companies are coming into neighborhoods with the power of eminent domain, with plans to run unodorized gas lines under front yards. The companies say it's perfectly safe. Neighborhood activist Jerry Lobdell says he feels baited and switched.
They came in, they spoke of bonus money and royalties. They never said anything about pipelines whatsoever or any of the other bad things that we have learned about. Now we're beginning to see what happens next.
Some are asking for a moratorium on urban drilling until its full impact is understood and there are stronger laws to protect the public. Don Young, a glass artist by trade, is leading the charge. He drove me around, and we talked about the consequences of the Barnett boom.
Historically, oil and gas helped build this city, Fort Worth, which is your hometown. So why are you so opposed to a new gas boom here?
Well, in the past, drilling was not taking place in the heart of the city. Now we're having all the problems associated with gas drilling. Compressor stations, pipelines, drill pads, they're taking away our green space, they're bringing in pollution, they're bringing in truck traffic, affecting our neighborhoods in a very negative way.
Talk like this prompted Chesapeake Energy to mount a media campaign almost as aggressive as its drilling program to highlight the company's safety and community-friendly agenda. An infomercial titled Citizens of the Shale has been airing on local television for months.
The trees can grow back, you can plant more grass. It's a small inconvenience for a big gain.
Temporary inconveniences, most residents admit they can live with.
I see the good that it's doing. There's hundreds of thousands of dollars coming into here. There's jobs being created.
Chesapeake Energy's CEO, Aubrey McClendon, is a big believer in aggressive media campaigns. He was a major backer of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth and other right-wing causes. The stock market value of his company tops $28 billion, and last year his compensation and stock options totaled nearly $19 million. In the wake of Citizens of the Shale, now comes Shale TV. The company has hired three award-winning Dallas broadcast journalists to produce a daily talk show on the Barnett to premiere this fall. Company Vice President for Corporate Development Julie Wilson says she understands their skepticism about the objectivity of Shale TV, but she insists it's no different than the rest of the corporate media.
Well, I think we pay those journalists, whether they're on Channel 8 or Channel 11 or the Star Telegram or others, in terms of advertising support. We see this as pretty much, instead of running the ads on the program, we're just writing the check direct.
Will people tune into Shale TV for straight talk on the natural gas boom? At a recent neighborhood meeting, a contractor named Dan Roberts, who says he's pro-drilling, was dubious.
With all the lipstick you put on it, it's still a pig. It is still a media campaign for the company to get people to sign their leases.
What no one disputes is that the Barnett has been gushing dollars. Every piece of property a drill bit snakes under, even though it's a mile underground, gets a signing bonus and a royalty check. A study commissioned by the Fort Worth Chamber of Commerce puts the total economic benefit at more than $8 billion and nearly 84,000 jobs. Fort Worth has new buildings going up, new pickups driving off lots, and big spenders bellying up to the bar. Marty Travis is general manager of Billy Bob's Texas, which bills itself the world's largest honky-tonk.
I've seen people's taste change. People are drinking a higher quality product, whether they're going from a Seagram's vodka to a Grey Goose vodka. Maybe they're celebrating their big paychecks that they've gotten from the working out in the Barnett field.
But boomtown prosperity may not pacify residents' anxiety over living next to a gas well.
All morning, emergency crews are on the scene of a gas well explosion in southern Tarrant County, and Forest Hill is being evacuated. And CBS 11's Eileen Gonzalez joins us now.
In April 2006, this blowout at a well southeast of town owned by XTO Energy killed a well service contractor. An OSHA investigation determined the contractors did not follow safe work practices on the high-pressure wellhead. On a recent night, Chesapeake representatives met in a Unitarian church with residents of the Ryan Place neighborhood to explain their proposed drilling activities in the area. A resident wanted to know.
Right. And so what kind of evacuation plan do you anticipate we should be looking to for that possibility?
Chesapeake operations manager Dave Leopold took her question.
What happened at Forest Hill literally got blown out of proportion. And the evacuation was unwarranted, and I think if you spoke to the fire chief today, he would say, we probably evacuated unnecessarily.
The next day, I tracked down Forest Hill's fire chief, Pat Ekus.
So do you feel like you overreacted in terms of evacuating people?
Absolutely not. I think total evacuation was about 516 residents in the city of Forest Hill. So much of this is unknown, and yet it is commonplace in West Texas, but we are taking a very rural mentality and bringing it into a municipal area, and those two don't often mix.
Which takes us back to the question we started with. How does the oil and gas industry, which the public is telling to boost its domestic reserves, exploit a formation in the middle of a crowded metropolis? The question has implications far beyond Fort Worth. The same advances in horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing that made the Barnett play possible are causing excitement in other shale formations. The Haynesville in Louisiana, the Marcellus in Pennsylvania, the Fayetteville in Arkansas, and the Woodford in Oklahoma. In each of these places, people will have to decide how to balance their royalty checks and their quality of life. John Burnett, NPR News.
Even with all of our technology, it's still a big world, and we're still learning about it. Experts say they've made a spectacular find in an isolated part of the Republic of Congo in Africa. It's a previously undiscovered population of Western lowland gorillas. The find more than doubles the number of lowland gorillas thought to be alive in Central Africa, as NPR's John Nielsen reports.
2 years ago, researchers from the New York-based Wildlife Conservation Society and Congolese wildlife experts started looking for gorillas in one of the least passable forests left on Earth. It's near the border between the Republic of Congo, Brazzaville, and Cameroon. Researchers had heard from people living nearby that there might be gorillas in these forests. If the researchers had found nothing, team leader Emma Stokes says she wouldn't have been surprised.
We were worried about that. You know, this is a block of forest that not many people are walking around in. So we didn't really know in some bits of this area what we were going to find. I mean, we really didn't.
They followed tracks, counted droppings, and found gorilla nests. And every now and then, after sitting on a platform for an hour or two, Stokes would see a gorilla come out into a swamp, and then another, and then a whole family. And there are infants playing in the swamp, she said. And the perfect moment is sitting there, seeing gorillas do what gorillas do. In the end, says Stokes, they found more gorillas than she thought possible.
I mean, we ran the analysis on this five times over. We weren't trusting the numbers we were getting, but the numbers kept coming in high, whichever way you looked at it. However conservative you were with the estimate, the numbers were still coming up very high.
The discovery was announced at a meeting of the International Primatological Society in Edinburgh, Scotland. Steve Sanderson, CEO and president of the Wildlife Conservation Society, said 125,000 gorillas live in these forests. That's more than the current world estimate for the species, which is somewhere between 50 and 100,000.
We have found a mother load of Western lowland gorillas. We had no idea that these great numbers and also densities, that is, numbers per square kilometer, were possible.
Sanderson says the apes in the mother lode are not being killed by the things that have all but wiped out gorilla populations in other parts of Central Africa. wars, commercial poaching, massive logging operations, and any number of diseases.
Diseases led by but not limited to the Ebola virus have created big empty holes in the forest where gorillas used to be but are no longer.
One of the main reasons these newly found gorillas have been avoiding these fates is obvious to anyone who's ever spent time in the swampy forest known as the Green Abyss. Like Richard Ruggiero of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who studied gorillas and elephants for 15 years in Central Africa. He didn't help with this census, but he knows the area well.
We call it the Green Abyss because we didn't know about it, and you go into it, and it's a world unto itself. It's, you know, these swamp environments are extremely difficult to get along in. There's literally no place to pitch a tent and sleep. You have to now walk on roots and in slippery places.
This is a notoriously difficult place to count anything. But even if the census numbers turn out to be a little high, Ruggiero says it's still an amazing find. He says that right now there aren't any logging operations in these forests, which means that the roads are all but non-existent. That in turn means there hasn't been much poaching or subsistence hunting. Basically, there aren't many humans here at all, he says. But that may be about to change. In recent years, Ruggiero says the government of the Republic of Congo has started to sell the right to log these forests.
Where there are natural resources in Africa, the rush to exploit them is at a pace that no one ever dreamt possible. It's horrific, frankly. The value of this announcement of this large populations is hopefully people will realize this is a chance to get there before the other guys do and to figure out a better way to plan, if you will, to manage the resource, if you will, than leaving it up to people with chainsaws and bulldozers. And that story tells itself, and it's a sad story.
Steve Sanderson of the Wildlife Conservation Society says the government of the Republic of Congo is considering a plan to turn a big part of this forested area into a wildlife park.
This new park, of the 125,000 estimated gorillas found, this new park has 73,000. So it's a big deal. And the establishment and maintenance of the park are difficult, but certainly not impossible.
Sanderson also says there are ways to save gorillas that won't be protected by a park. In recent years, his group has helped big logging operations in other parts of the Republic of Congo learn to harvest trees sustainably and to limit poaching operations that rely on logging roads. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.
They were hard to find, but these gorillas are not camera shy, and you can watch a video of them eating, playing, and generally goofing around at NPR.org.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick. Where is that trumpet fanfare? Beijing, let the games begin.
Well, Alex, actually, they have begun. I'm Madeline Brand. The big ceremony doesn't come for another couple of days, but official Olympic soccer matches, they're already underway. The American women's team lost to Norway.
So how is the air in the heavily polluted Chinese capital? We're calling Kenneth Ron. He's professor emeritus of atmospheric chemistry at the University of Rhode Island and a senior research scholar at Tsinghua University in Beijing. Ken, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to return.
And what is the number?
The number now is in the mid-80s. Individual sites around Beijing have exceeded the 100 mark. One of them I saw got up almost to 120, but the average over the city is in the mid-80s at this point.
When we spoke last week, you explained these numbers. The Chinese say their benchmark is 100. Anything below 100 is, they would say, healthy. For U.S. air quality, that would not be healthy.
No, that's right. This is really in the unhealthy zone. We would make our dividing line somewhere maybe around 25 or something like that. So we're talking about levels in Beijing that are several times higher than what we would consider acceptable and that are several times higher than what we would experience, at least in the eastern part of the United States.
So at the air pollution, air quality level in Beijing today, in most U.S. cities, would we have one of these warnings out? If you're old or you're sick or you're a young kid, you should stay indoors?
Those are usually based on ozone measurements. And ozone in Beijing is actually not all that bad. It's repeatedly high, but it's not excessive to the extent that particulate matter is, which is the governing pollutant for the API, Air Pollution Index, most days.
So it was lower a few days ago. What happened?
It was low because they had a period of north winds and rain. And then, as happens after a front comes through, the winds slow down, it's not raining anymore, and the pollution climbs. One of my friends on the ground in Beijing tells me that he can see the pollution increasing by the hour over there now. This was a day or two ago. He could see buildings disappearing during the day. That's exactly consistent with a jump from 30-something to 80-something in one day. It's still in the mid-80s on the average now. So by Chinese standards, this is in the healthy zone. By Western standards, not.
We'll note that you are looking at and following closely official Chinese air quality monitoring stations. These numbers are reported. You find them on the Internet. So that's how you know exactly what's going on. What do you expect by Friday, the opening day?
Well, it's a little bit of a mixed picture at this point. If I had to predict now, I would say that it's probably going to stay about the same as it is now. And then it's going to break. This whole system is going to break as forecast right about the time of the opening ceremonies. And maybe they have rain and maybe they don't. Maybe they have thunderstorms and maybe they don't. But right now it looks as if it's going to reach its peak in the midpoint of the day on the day of the opening ceremonies on Friday.
You mentioned rain on Friday. Rain might be as good as wind.
I think that, in general, wind is better than rain, especially if wind brings in new air masses. The key to clean air in Beijing is much less rain and much more winds and fresh air masses coming in, clean air masses arriving. Rain removes pollutants best up at the cloud level and not so much down at the ground.
Thing is, you can't make the wind blow, but maybe you can make it rain.
Maybe is the operative word here.
Professor Emeritus Ken Ron from the University of Rhode Island and a senior research scholar at Tsinghua University in Beijing. Ken, thank you again.
You're welcome, Alex. Anytime.
One of those competing demands will be our subject on Morning Edition this week. We're going to examine some attempts to solve the shortage of affordable food. And we'll focus on the experience of one country in Central America, Honduras. In that one small country, you can see almost every part of the global food situation. NPR's Dan Charles reports it's a country where farming is back in fashion.
When it comes to growing food, Honduras has everything. It's a miniature version of the whole world. There's a little bit of Iowa here in the Comayagua Valley. Rodolfo Rubio's corn is tall and green and genetically engineered.
With biotechnology, we feel like we're part of first world agriculture. We don't have to be jealous of our cornfields in Iowa.
And just like those farmers in Iowa, he's making good profits these days. Other cornfields could just as easily be in some of the poorest parts of Africa.
Primero se limpia antes de quemar.
First, we clear off the field. We cut the weeds, then burn them, and then spray with chemicals.
Santiago Gonzalez grows corn and beans on a rocky hillside near Lake Yohoa.
We plant by hand because we don't have the resources for machinery.
Even though he grows food, Gonzalez doesn't grow enough to feed his own family year-round. And when he goes to the market these days, rice costs twice what it did a year ago. Beans, 50% more.
Sometimes we eat, and sometimes we don't. And when we eat, it's very poorly, because our situation is very difficult here. And I can tell you this, we and our children and our grandchildren will have to eat each other when we're hungry.
The story is similar across the globe. Expensive food and empty stomachs. There have been food riots from Haiti to Egypt. It's forced government officials in Honduras to reconsider a lot of things they thought they knew about food and farming. Officials like Arturo Gallo. He's in charge of science and technology for the Honduran Ministry of Agriculture.
20 years ago, the international institution told us that there was no sense, you know, to produce grains, that we better buy them and bring them from outside.
It seemed that Honduras's traditional farmers, the ones with just a few acres of poor land, could never compete with corn or rice from the U.S. or Argentina.
In the last two decades, grain producers went broke.
The world's smartest economists told the Honduran government growing corn and beans is for losers. Invest your money, they said, in things with a future, textile exports or tourism, and those subsistence farmers will get real jobs in the city. The government of Honduras neglected its small farmers, and the country now imports most of its corn and rice. But Porfirio Lobo, the leader of the opposition National Party, who's running for president, says those policies now are changing.
It has to change. As bad as wars are, it's even more dangerous not to have enough food.
Arturo Gallo's agency within the Ministry of Agriculture has begun a massive effort to distribute fertilizer and seeds to 250,000 of the country's smallest farmers, the ones growing corn and beans.
We believe, you know, in this government, that the first thing that we had to do is to provide food for our population.
There's a lot of skepticism in Honduras about that program. Some critics say the government is just trying to buy votes. But it is a signal that farmers aren't forgotten anymore. And this is true far beyond the borders of Honduras. Robert Townsend, a senior economist at the World Bank in Washington, says around the world, farmers, international organizations, and private foundations are sinking money into food production.
So I think it's a global response. And from our own part, we're scaling up our support for agricultural development, particularly in Africa.
They're sending out agricultural advisors, building roads into previously isolated areas, providing seeds and fertilizer for reasonable prices. Some of these programs started even before the current food crisis, but now they've become urgent. Townsend believes they will work. Poor farmers can grow more food. What's not so clear is whether they can do it quickly. For NPR News, I'm Dan Charles.
Tomorrow, we'll keep learning how one country is responding to the food crisis. Part of the problem is getting food to market, and part of the solution may involve Walmart.